will proceed with our next case, which is case number 57859, Miguel Antonio Mariano versus the State of Nevada. We have Ms. Dickinson representing the appellant, Mr. Murbach representing the respondent. Before we proceed, I just want to make one disclosure to the parties. Several months ago, I gave a tip, appellate presentation to the District Attorney's Office on appellate tips, oral argument tips, and practice, and I did the same for the public defenders on Friday. Afternoon, and Ms. Dickinson was there, and I frankly read this stuff on Monday. I didn't remember even who the attorneys were for today's case, so I looked at this morning, but just so you know, I gave you some appellate tips and on Friday afternoon as well, but it basically was the same outline, the same material was given to the District Attorney's Office. And, okay, with that in mind, Ms. Dickinson, you may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Miguel Mariano. There are several reasons why this court should reverse Miguel's convictions. But I'd like to begin with issue two, because there's a recent case that this court decided in April that is dispositive. In April, this court decided Carter v. State and held that a defendant who says, "Can I have an attorney?" has made an unequivocal request to have an attorney aid him after he's been given his Miranda rights. Now, in Carter, the district court held a suppression hearing. The defendant testified that on his way to jail, he made that statement. When the detective testified at the suppression hearing, he indicated, well, the defendant did say something about an attorney, but it wasn't enough that he thought he was invoking his right to have an attorney. This court said the detective was incorrect. So it wasn't a test on what the detective said, it was a test on what the defendant did. The exact same thing happened in this case. In this case, when Miguel was interrogated by the detective, on page 20, he made a statement, which we don't know what exactly the statement is, because part of it was unintelligible. He said, "I need a," unintelligible, "blaming me, unintelligible." The response from the detective was, "Okay, yes," and then the transcript indicates two people are talking. The defense filed a pretrial motion to suppress any statements Miguel made, and when asked about this portion of the statement, Detective LaBelle said he thought that Miguel said, "If you're blaming me for rape." He also said that it's possible that Miguel said, "I need an attorney if you're blaming me for rape." So it's possible that he couldn't remember. So the defense attorney had the detective listen to the audio portion rather than the transcribed portion. Afterwards, he said that, "Well, Miguel may have said abogado," attorney in Spanish. And he said again, "He may have said that," but he did not specifically remember. Now, Miguel testified that when he listened to the tape, he did remember asking for an attorney, saying abogado. Now, this is important because the Carter case tells us to look at what the defendant said. And here we have a transcript that is kind of vague, but we have a detective who admits that he heard the word on the tape. And we have a defendant who says, "That's what I said," on page 20. So in the Carter case, what this court did is they looked for harmless error. And they found them, and they reversed. And I submit the court would not find them this error here. For one thing, this particular detective, his whole testimony was Miguel's statements. Moreover, the state introduced his statements all over the place. Video, audio, transcripts. We'd have to exclude Exhibit 15, 29, 30, and 31. And after he asked for an attorney, there was a time in the interrogation that he suggested Miguel should ask for forgiveness. So Miguel wrote a note. Didn't admit the crime, but asked for forgiveness. That would have to be excluded also. Oh, and this same detective, after he asked for attorney, obtained a buckle swab. So that would suggest it would have to be examined to see if the DNA evidence needed to be excluded. And then there was a map that was introduced. That would need to be excluded also. So I submit to you that based on Carter, this case needs to be reversed because he asked for an attorney and the state introduced 109 pages of his testimony afterwards and used it to incriminate him. With regard to issue two, which is very troubling because it gets under cross-examination, before I get any further, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Yes.
I think I did. The Sixth Amendment guarantees a criminal defendant the right to cross-examine the witness against him at trial. In this case, Miguel was denied that right. What happened was the court put restrictions on what questions he could ask Lola, who was the complaining witness, the sole eyewitness. She spoke Spanish, Miguel spoke Spanish. There were some detectives that interviewed her that, I'm not sure, spoke Spanish. So there were some inconsistencies. And we had a transcribed tape statement that was taken about 2 to 3 hours after she originally called 911. And that, like many of the other transcripts that we had, had a lot of blanks and spaces and unintelligible in it. And there was one part in particular where the detective says to her, "Do you want to add anything to this?" And she did. She said, and there's a space, "If you find him, to lock him up, space, to deport him because, space, I was very scared then, space." So that's what we had. Based on this, the defense attorney questioned her about why she wanted him deported. She suggested, "You were angry, you were mad." And the prosecutor objected, said, "Those weren't her words." Well, we don't exactly have all her words here, but we know she's made several different statements to the nurse, to the police officer who responded, and this is the only written statement. So when the defense attorney tried to explain, she was trying to get to motive or bias. The court initially let her ask questions, but then had the CD burn, looked at it, gave it to the prosecutor overnight, so he had some good evidence to have a look at before he went further and was redirect. And when it came the next day, she had sort of a disciplinary hearing where she told the defense attorney that she was out of line. She should not have been asking those questions. And the more the defense attorney disagreed, the more the court got upset. So her remedy was to restrict further cross-examination unless the defense attorney could point to a page and a line number in the video, I mean the audio transcription that she was referring to. Clearly, that took away the defense attorney's total right to cross-examination at this point because the court gave the prosecutor the right to use leading questions and go through the transcript to suggest that all of these were consistent. Well, cross-examining a witness, especially a sole eyewitness, with statements they've made before, it's just not to show inconsistent or consistent statements. It's to show bias and motive to go ahead and not tell the truth, which is basically the defense here. Courts have Bobby, Drake, and Cox in the Stennett cases. The courts have always allowed the defense to get into these areas. Another area that the court prohibited the defense from getting into was an area about her illegal status. In fact, they brought it up, the court said no, and then they had an evidentiary hearing where the court had the defense attorney ask all the questions she'd like to ask her on cross. You know, like, where have you worked? She worked in a casino. Did you identify that you're here legally? No, she didn't, but she got paid, which suggests she didn't have a social security number. She had a green card. The court said none of this was admissible. So basically, the court violated the U.S. Supreme Court case of Holmes versus South Carolina, where in that case, the judge made a determination of what evidence was coming in before it came in. Here, the judge had a hearing outside the presence of the jury, decided what we could ask on cross-examination, and then said no. That clearly violates her right of confrontation.
What's the relevance of the immigration status?
Well, it gets to the U visa, because there is a visa that a complaining victim of battered domestic violence or sexual assault or any of that types of crimes of violence can get temporary asylum in the United States, and it can lead to permanent status as a citizen. So what happened is the defense attorney brought in a document to explain to the court why this was important, that this U visa was available. But the court had her ask the complaining witness, and the complaining witness says, I don't know anything about it. That was enough for the court. I submit that it should have been in front of the jury, and it's up to the jury to decide if this complaining witness knew anything about it, because she certainly knew something about deportation, because she brought it up on her own. What do you even ask her?
Counsel, let's go back in terms of what you're offering. This particular visa status, was there any showing made to the court that she had made an application under this?
No.
Was there anything offered?
Well, I believe what occurred was, prior to trial, the defense on many times tried to get information from the state as to the deportation and her status, and she was, we were told to find it yourself. Mm-hmm. And they didn't find anything, because we don't have access to those records, obviously. And so there was just a hearing where we asked her about her if she had applied or if she knew about it. So no, we did not have any documents to show she had submitted it. And I'm not sure she would be submitting it at this point, because this was in the middle of the case.
Okay. Did you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Please, and
I'll just go before she sits down and realize time, but there were two other issues raised. One is of some importance and the other not, so we don't just get it on her reservation, whether or not she wishes to talk about the interpreter issue or the jury, either one of them, or whether she just was going to submit them on the grace.
With the interpreter issue and the, what was the other issue?
And the also alleged jury bias.
The jury bias, or the challenge for cause, is that what you mean? Basically, quickly, I'll go through. He spoke China Teka, and we tried for a long time to find an interpreter. In fact, I think they did find one, but then he wasn't available, or there was a problem with his ability to translate. I think it's a serious problem here that they used a Spanish interpreter, because at one point during the trial, the judge says to Miguel, do you understand what's going on? He says, well, not exactly. I'm trying. And she just moves on. So there was no attempt to make sure he really understood the proceedings. And if you look at his statement that he made to the police officer, yes, he did understand a lot, but he didn't understand everything, because some of his questions didn't exactly correlate with what the question was. And what's important about this issue is that the court interpreter's office has said he needed a China Tech interpreter. And so it wasn't just the defense asking for it. And the second thing that's important about this, it was troubling because the court went out of her way to go ahead and on her own get documents from the jail to go ahead and use to say, well, I've looked at these documents. It looks like he's submitted kites, so I think that he's functioning fine in Spanish. I don't think that's the test. We don't even know if he had written those kites. With regard to the jury bias, there was two jurors who said that they would have a problem if a defendant was a here illegally, because that's a crime. Although the court allowed one of them off, she didn't allow the other one off, and we had eventually lose our own peremptory challenge to remove that particular juror. So we lost her right to a peremptory challenge. If I could just smoke
okay.
It.
Thank you very much. Mr. Robeck. Please, the court, Jake Murdock, First State of Nevada. I'll begin by discussing the suppression issue. I think it's important to understand how the potential word abogado or attorney even became a part of the proceedings in this case. I was the trial attorney in the case, and the detective testified that he did not hear that word used or the defendant say that word during the interview. It was not until the hearing, and it's important to remember that the transcript itself is unintelligible. It doesn't have the word attorney in there. It doesn't say out about it in the transcript. During the hearing, the defense attorney plays that portion of the statement. And then the defense attorney herself asked that that portion be played a second time. So all the parties sitting there in court, we listened to it two different times, and the detective says, well, it's kind of mumbly, and once again, we're speaking over each other
but he may have said Alvarado. That's what the detective said.
Should the court be concerned that the officer just ignored the statements by the defendant? Yeah. Chose to ignore at the time?
I think if there was evidence that the detective had heard the defendant say that word and he ignored it, then absolutely, that would be a great concern to the court.
The detective on the record seemed to testify that you and I were talking over each other, which would seem that he didn't listen to the responses given by the defendant.
Well, I think that for the most part, if you look at the entire transcript, the detective's interview of the defendant, there, he is listening to the defendant, and there's multiple occasions where the defendant gives detailed statements in regards to different issues and what occurred. There were a couple of times, and I think that this happens in all transcripts, where one person starts to talk, another person starts to talk, and then they stop, and then they allow one person to proceed forward. Did that occur in this case? It did happen a few times. Should that happen? I would like a transcript where it doesn't happen, but I think it happens in a huge percentage of the transcripts that we have that occurs. Did that word get missed because of this? I don't know. The point is that at this point in time, there's no evidence that that word was used, that that was said. The detective testifies, after listening to it two different times in that controlled environment, that the defendant may have used that word. But even then, he can't say definitively that the defendant uses that word.
How much now? Let me get the sequence in here. So the defendant was raised rights in Spanish by the detective before it started. He apparently made some statements, and at some point in time, possibly, we're not sure if the word abogado came up, and like that. Do you know what he said before that? Ms. Higgins' argument is once you say abogado to Carter, you're done. And so, but maybe anything that happened before that potentially is admissible, then like.
There were some statements in regards to what was going on, what the accusations were. I don't recall exactly word for word what was said before and what was said after. What I do know is that the detective never heard that word, and he testified in detail under oath at the hearing that if he would have heard that word, if he would have heard the defendant say that, he would have stopped immediately. That's his normal course, that's the way he functions, and that he did not hear it during the transcript during that interview. And I think that distinguishes this case from the Carter case. In Carter, the detective says, well, he did say something to me about an attorney, but I decided that it wasn't specific enough, so I just moved forward. That's not what happened in this case.
It sounds kind of close.
But in this case, the detective doesn't hear it during the interview. When the actual interview occurs, he never hears the word. He never believes the defendant's asked for an attorney. He doesn't think that at all. It's not until the hearing in front of the judge, more than a year later, where the statement is played for him two different times by the defense attorney, and he listens to it, and he says, well, there's some mumbling in there, and there's some talking over, but he may have said the word abogado. And he never specifically says, I know that's what he said, he clearly said it. He says he may have said that word. And the defendant himself, when he testified, said, he was asked by defense counsel, do you remember asking for an attorney? Do you remember saying that you need an attorney? And the defendant said, yes, no. No, 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 I don't remember. No, no, sorry. So even the defendant himself doesn't remember saying that he asked for an attorney, or doesn't remember asking for an attorney during the interview. It's not until afterwards, when the statement is played two different times, in the controlled environment of court, that this issue even comes out. So I think
your suggestion is that what was heard in court after it was played twice is not what we think, or the those who were there thought it was, and that's sort of the preliminary question. My other question is, I'm a bit concerned about, in light of Carter, I'm pretty familiar with that case, in light of Carter, I'm concerned about allowing some type of an exception to be made that says, well, I didn't hear him say that, so that's why I kept questioning.
But in this case, there isn't at this point any evidence that it was said. There's absolutely...
The tape was wrong. Even though some people in court said, yeah, it could be abogado.
Well, what they said was, it could be it. They didn't say, nobody could definitively say that's absolutely what's being said. In fact, the person who wrote the transcript, who's not a part of this case, who has nothing to do with it, couldn't figure out what the word was. They wrote unintelligible in the transcript. So nobody's definitively said, nobody could say he absolutely said, I asked for an attorney. The court itself listened to it multiple times and couldn't figure out what the word was said. The interpreter's office listened
But then that draws me to the other issue. In my mind, and we've had a couple of cases that have dealt with this, in my mind, the interpretation, the correct dialect, clear, adequate interpretation is so important to these cases for some of the reasons that we're talking about here today. Do we need to be concerned about that as well? And that's an issue certain that the appellant raises.
Are you referencing the Chin Tech interpretation? You know, I think that issue was litigated intensely prior to the start of this case. And the state had no problem if a Chin Tech interpreter would have come in. And the court made substantial efforts to try to find one. In fact, they allowed the defense a significant amount of time to attempt to locate a Chin Tech interpreter. Courts and versions. But the problem was is that it just wasn't feasible. It couldn't be done. And in fact, in the end, the defendant himself refused to continue to waive his right to trial and didn't want to continue the case. The defense attorney says, it's still our position that Mr. Mariano needs a Chin Tech interpreter. However, we're realistic about the possibility occurring and done a complete and exhaustive nationwide search. I don't know if it's going to reveal anything, especially considering the fact that he does not want to waive. He does not want to extend the date of the trial anymore. So there wasn't, it's not like the defendant said, hey, I speak Chin Tech and everyone ignored it. We had six different pretrial hearings in which that issue was raised. There are multiple individuals in Mexico and in California that were contacted by the defense and by the court in an attempt to try to bring someone there that spoke Chin Tech. The biggest problem was they couldn't find anyone who spoke Chin Tech in English. In fact, the one person they found that actually spoke Chin Tech said to the defense attorney over the phone, no other than Russ, and they would have had to have had a Chin Tech interpreter talking to a Spanish interpreter, translating to English. So it would have been extremely difficult. There were efforts made, and in the end, I think if the defendant would have said, I want a Chin Tech interpreter, I'm willing to wait, continue the case again to try to find one, the court potentially would have done that.
What was the evidence of how well the defendants, whether the appellant who spoke Spanish?
There was substantial evidence. First of all, the entire interview was conducted in Spanish with Detective Ribario. The interpreter's office listened to the interview and indicated that clearly the defendant spoke Spanish. And I want to emphasize one thing. Counsel indicated that...
It wasn't just the same interpreter office that indicated a number of things in the audible?
No, that would be different. That would be a different... This is the certified court interpreter's office, which would be different than who's doing the transcription of the statement itself.
Shouldn't we look at that also as relevant to whether he understood or didn't understand, or was fluent enough in Spanish to understand?
I missed that.
I guess the question is, what do we pick and choose to look at to determine whether or not he's fluent, sufficient in the language?
Well, I think we look at the interview itself, which the court interpreter's office listened to. They didn't look at the transcript. They listened to the statement. They also spoke with the defendant. And the court interpreter's office said he clearly speaks Spanish. Now, they never said he's going to need a Chin Tech interpreter, which is what counsel alluded to. What they said was it could be helpful. And that's not the standard. The standard is if he was fluent enough to understand the proceedings in a meaningful sense. And the interpreter's office said, we listened to the statement, we've spoken to him, he clearly understands and speaks Spanish. The detective himself, who speaks Spanish, spoke to him for 2 hours. He was asked questions, did he seem to understand what you were talking about? Did he talk to you in Spanish? Yes, he did. The whole interview was in Spanish. I think it's important to note also the defendant himself said that he only spoke Chin Tech with his family, that he lived in Osaka, Mexico for only a short period of time in his life, which is where Chin Tech is the people who speak Chin Tech live. However, in Osaka, Mexico, the main language is Spanish. He admitted that in his day-to-day life and everything he did, he speaks Spanish. He only spoke Chin Tech with his family. And since he's been in the United States, I think it was for 9 years, the only person who ever speaks Chin Tech to is his brother. So he's lived in the United States for 9 years, and he's done all of that in Spanish. Everywhere he goes, every job he's had, everything he's done has been in Spanish. And the standard is not that the defendant himself wanted a Chin Tech interpreter. The standard is, could he understand Spanish to the point where he could understand the proceedings in a meaningful sense, which is from the Tom versus State case. And that's clear here, that he spoke Spanish sufficiently to understand the proceedings and this is what was going on. And the court made substantial efforts, and the defense made substantial efforts to locate a Chin type of interpreter. It just wasn't possible. I think one thing that's interesting is that even in Osaka, Mexico, where this language is spoken, it's one of multiple indigenous dialects in that particular area. And only a very small percentage of the people that speak indigenous dialect in that area even speak Chinteco. So there's really a reality issue here. And the defense recognized that when it said, we've done this nationwide search and it's just not realistic. And he refuses to waive. He demands that he goes, that he not become trial, not be continued again. And so we went to trial, and he had a Spanish interpreter the entire time.
What about this issue of the immigration status of the complaining witness?
Well, that was another issue that was addressed multiple times prior to trial and even during trial. And the defense was on two different occasions. Well, first of all, one thing I should say that's important is there was comment by counsel that the state said, go find it yourself. In regards to discovery issues, that's not what happened. The defense filed a discovery motion. It was granted by the court, and there was discovery provided by the state. There was some phone calls the state made and some things the state did which were given to the defense. And as this trial proceeded, as it went to trial, the defense never said, the state refused to help us out. The state refused to do anything to help us find out what was going on with immigration status. That's just not true. That's not what happened. Then there were two different hearings outside the presence in which the defense was allowed to ask questions of this victim in regards to her immigration status. And she testified truthfully. She said she was in the country illegally. She said she had never applied for any type of change in her status. She said that she didn't know anything about a U visa program or how to obtain one. She had never talked to anyone in the DA's office about changing her immigration status. She had never lied about her immigration status. And the defense, in both of these hearings, had absolutely no evidence, despite the granting of the discovery motion, despite their efforts, to show that any of what she was saying was untrue. I would agree, if there was some evidence that she had lied about her immigration status, that she had said something that wasn't true, and she can be impeached with, that clearly becomes relevant and now it goes to her credibility. But she wasn't. She was honest about the whole entire thing, and just the fact that she is illegal doesn't in and of itself make her not a credible witness. And the court even said that. The mere existence of the U visa program, absent showing that the victim knew about it beforehand or took steps to exploit it, does not establish any type of relevance. She didn't know anything about the U visa program. That question was asked of her multiple times. There was no evidence to show she knew anything about it or anyone to talk to her about it.
Okay. Next issue, Ms. Dickinson said about the judge excused one prospective juror for cause on relating about the immigration status issue but didn't on the other one. Isn't that an abuse of discretion not to excuse the other juror, assuming that's the way it happened?
Well, first of all, in order for there to be, under the Blade case, in order for there to be some type of an issue here, they have to show that the actual impaneled jury had some type of bias, which didn't happen in this case, because the juror they're questioning, which is number 517, was struck by them with a peremptory challenge. But I think it's important to note that juror was rehabilitated and said that he would follow the law, that he understood immigration status wasn't important. This was not a case about that. He indicated he had no problem with that. He indicated he was willing to follow the law and that he would not consider that in any way during the testimony. So there were some statements originally made by juror number 473, which were somewhat inflammatory in regards to someone who was in the country illegally. And that person was kicked, and I had no problem with that person being kicked. I agree they need to be. But juror 517 simply made some comments kind of on the end of what juror 473 had said. And it didn't appear that juror had the same position that juror 473 did. And so with some questioning in regards to what the law was and whether he could follow the law, he clearly said he understood and would be willing to follow the law and wouldn't allow that issue going away.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. Ms. Dickinson, you have about 2.5 minutes left.
But going back to issue two about the officer and what he heard or did not hear and what he chose not to hear, I think it's important to look at this officer's common practice. He's the one who knows how the audio works. He knows that one person has to speak and the other person has to be quiet so it can be recorded correctly. So I don't think we can blame Miguel for speaking over. It's the officer. He's familiar with this practice. He knows what is going on. In fact, he's so familiar with it, we know that after he received the transcription from the cassette, he knew part of it was missing. Because what he did in this interrogation is he clicked off the cassette, left, came back and didn't put it back on, and the last 15 minutes or so was from the video. And it was not transcribed until the day of trial, or shortly around that time. So his common practice was not to make sure that everything was correctly recorded so that it could be used at trial. We know this. He turned off the cassette, didn't turn it back on, and then when the defense attorney asked him, well, you knew the transcription was missing something, you didn't tell anybody, did you? And he said no.
What about the, your opposing counsel said that your client testified that he didn't request an attorney, you know, like that. Shouldn't that be binding on him, a statement, you know, rather than trying to speculate if the word obligado was mentioned in this interview? What's your thoughts on that?
What the prosecutor is talking about is that when they first asked him at the suppression hearing, he began speaking about requesting somebody from the university. What happened was the defense attorney played it, I believe, twice, and then he said, obligado. And she said, well, why didn't you say obligado the first time I asked you? And he said, well, you know, it's been a long time. I didn't remember exactly the word I used. Again, we're dealing with someone who is unfamiliar with English and not totally familiar with Spanish. So he did say that. Like, it's the same thing with the detective. Initially, he said no, and then after he listened to it, he said yes, possibly.
Go ahead and finish your thoughts.
With regard to the interpreter issue and the fact that the court did so much to try to get this interpreter, it was the defense who did it. It wasn't the court. The defense were the ones who were trying to locate interpreters throughout the country. They had difficulty. It was the court who got the records from the jail on her own and then said, well, he can understand Spanish. So the fact that it was too difficult didn't mean it was impossible. It just meant there was only one person doing it. If the court had helped out, perhaps we would have gotten an interpreter that could have helped.
Well, I guess, Ms. Dickens, my biggest concern was, you know, we don't know how well he speaks Spanish, you know, and I guess none of us in this room would know that, but the fact he said, I want to go to trial and I don't want to continue to look for this interpreter, that was his choice. He had a right to go to trial. How do we deal with that?
Well, I would compare it to somebody who's not competent. I mean, if somebody is not competent and they say, I want to go to trial, the court makes a decision.
Shown from the defense that he was not able to assist his attorneys in going to trial, and that would kind of go to a quasi-competency issue. If I read as we get in the language, there's no statement as to that. I know that he wished to go to trial, and the defense maybe said, well, we don't understand what he's saying, he can't assist us or anything like that. So how do we kind of get there?
I think the way we could get there in the future, and in this case, is require the court to make some sort of hearing, evidentiary hearing. That never occurred here. I've seen cases where the court has brought in an interpreter and had the interpreter first.
But did the defense request it?
They did not request it in this case. But, you know, they did request the interpreter for several years. I think this went on for quite a long time, more than a year.
Mr. Sapp, I'm going to have to conclude here. I understand your argument on the you required to use a peremptory challenge on the sitter juror. I think that's pretty well. I think I understand from both sides what happened there and the other issues you raised in your brief as well. So with that in mind, thank you both for your excellent arguments and briefs, and we will take this case under submission, and the court will be in recess to 11:30.